I'm talking to Gail Scott, and well, I've been talking about this on the show for the last couple of weeks. So Gail Scott has just published Maine Brides Against Ochre Pediment and Aztec Sky, which is available from Coach House Press for $16.95. Now, Gail Scott has been writing for a long time. She came to Montreal in the 60s when she was just a youngin' of 24.
Very late 60s.
So, because this is going to make people know your age or sort of start calculating furiously. So you've been in Montreal for quite a while, and you've seen some changes in the city that have been expressed in your writing, I guess. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Sure, but what changes are you referring to that you see in my writing?
I see, Gail Scott's earlier novel, Heroine, was about a woman talking about the political situation mm-hmm. in Quebec and being in feminist groups and working with other organizations and really seeing a lot of linguistic tension and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And I know that that's played a crucial part in your earlier work. Mm-hmm. And I also think that the heroine in Maine Brides is more, a little bit more engaged and is looking at a slightly different picture. Do you agree?
More engaged in the sense of engagé? No, you don't mean that. What do you mean by more engaged?
Why don't you tell me?
Well, because I don't really know what you mean. I would say she's less engaged, if you mean engaged in the sense of engagé or involved.
Why would you say that?
Well, she's sitting sitting in a bar after having seen earlier in the day the body of a young woman in a park. So the whole book is kind of structured around this really traumatic moment at the beginning of the day. And her response to it is to go to a bar, sit there, and drink. She doesn't think about she doesn't think directly about the cause and effect of the situation, if you like, the way the heroine in Heroine did, who was sitting in the bathtub all the time, kind of deconstructing and reconstructing a political discourse. This woman's relationship to the city around her is, now I'm beginning to see what you mean by more engaged. Yes, it's a much more external relationship. It's much more a relationship to the social context. She's sitting in the bar. She's thinking about what it is that what women do about their fear, I guess. How women resist not only physically but also how women resist in the way they look at the world, the kind of downer that comes from a situation like this. I remember last fall, every month it seemed there was the body of another woman being found somewhere, and that was actually when I was writing the last draft of the novel. She's sitting in the bar and she's looking out and she's thinking about. It says in the book somewhere she's waiting not for love but for history. That was important to specify, since in Heroine she seems to be waiting for love all the time, or at least. That's the way a lot of people read it. I'm not sure that's absolutely true, but in this one I wanted to make it clear she's waiting for history this time. And the kind of history she imagines is a history of change. She calls it lust and revolution. She sees history as something that happens in the present, basically, and she's looking for the greedy decade, the 80s, to give way to what she calls the decade of lust and revolution, because it's 1990. So the people on the street figure into what she's thinking about. She imagines the portraits of some of them, the architecture around, the motifs on the top of the buildings in this part of Montreal, which are so crazy and so interesting and so full of meaning, and so on.
Okay. Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah, we understand each other. I know now what you mean by engaged. Right. You're right.
So I see Heroine is dealing a lot with the 70s, mm-hmm. and Maine Brides is dealing with the 80s, as you say. And the other change I saw was that in Heroine, the heroine was obsessed with a man.
Mm-hmm.
And in Maine Brides, has that changed?
Well, first of all, I think Maine Brides really deals with the present. It deals with 1990. It really deals with the moment she's sitting in the bar. The people she sees walking across the bar are the people of now, of the moment. She doesn't take on the past really, except as memory creeps in once in a while. You know, she'll something will happen to make her associate with something that's happened to her. But generally speaking, it's much more externalized, and she's really kind of imagining across the present. In Heroine, there's a quote from Umberto Eco in the front of the of Heroine, which talks about signs and loss. I don't know if I can remember it exactly, but it's something like, we use the signs and the signs of signs only when we don't have the thing itself, or something like that. And I think Heroine is a lot about loss. It's true that she's sitting there in the bathtub having the most hopelessly melodramatic memories of a love affair with a left leader. At the same time, she has her eye on Marie, who's sitting in the other room, and it's interesting, because men read Heroine often and think it's a lesbian novel. Lesbians read it and think it's a heterosexual novel. So I don't know what you can do with that. I think it's an interesting kind of conundrum. In Maine Brides, there are different things going on structurally. The narrator, whose name is Lydia, and who's seen this death and murder in the park, or seen the result of the murder in the park, in telling herself stories, creates a relationship of desire with each of her subjects. And this, I think, becomes increasingly intense as the novel progresses. And in almost every story, there is either some small sign that Lydia desires at least one of the characters in the story, or in some cases they are, I would say, 3 out of the 7 portraits are portraits about lesbians. So it's that's the way it is.
Okay, so you focus a lot on desire, and you had a phrase earlier about lust, and so that's a real, is that the sort of touchstone of the book, or? How important is desire?
How important is desire? Somebody in Toronto was interviewing me for this book recently, and they said that they'd read it, and, or a friend of theirs had read it, and said it's about sex in the head. And at the time, I thought, what does that mean, sex in the head? It must mean that the character is constantly thinking about sex, which in fact she isn't. And then it occurred to me after that, sex in the head means you're all thinking and no acting. I don't know. I don't know what it means.
This a bit passive, like sex in the bathtub.
Yeah, right. This is desire. I think that there is a kind of real attempt at making the world around her into a more sensual place, and she really relates to the world through her senses. There's a lot about there's smells of food. There's a lot of interest in the clothes that the various different kinds of people wear walking by the window, particularly the women, basically, and smells, and the various shades of sunset, of the color of sunset. I don't know if you've ever noticed this on this sort of streets that run north and south of Montreal, but when the sun starts to set, the light reverberates off the windows on both sides, and on a really bright summer day, it's the most wonderful thing. There is desire in terms of sexual desire. There is also a lot of music in the text as a kind of backdrop, which is also a form of sensuality. And I think also the language is at least for me, this book is kind of like what do you call it, a tone poem in music. It really functions on a sort of very poetic level, and so I think the language itself is very sensuous. That's how I see desire now.
Okay. I'm interested in your comment about clothing, because I think that fashion is one of the few sanctioned ways that women can pay attention to each other, even when they're not lesbians. Mm-hmm. And were you playing with that in the book?
Probably, on some level. For me, the way people dress is a kind of trope for a period, for an intersection between the period they live in, what they're trying to represent themselves at, etc. And it really interests me as a form of self-expression. So that's one of the things that I'm playing with it all. And I actually have in all of my prose fiction talked a lot about clothes, not in a high, not because I'm that interested in fashion per se, but then I'm just interested in the way people express themselves through the way they dress and how it changes all the time.
Right.
There's a section, for example, in this book which talks about how the late 80s was a period of hats, and then all the different kinds of hats people wore.
What do you think of the way lesbians dress? I'm just curious.
Which lesbians?
Not all lesbians. the sort of lesbian uniform, I hasten to add.
The lesbian uniform, I think, is...
What do you think when you go to a bar and you see a lot of lesbians dressed the same way? How's that?
Do you mean jeans and... what do you mean? Jeans and boots and a sort of...
Because well, I notice no, you don't dress that way.
They're not the ones I look at.
Well, what you now tell me is not an excerpt, but is sort of a précis, you mm-hmm, said, for mm-hmm. Maine Brides that was published in Massachusetts Review, I guess, a couple of years ago now.
Yeah.
The character is talking about how hideous her lesbian lover, mm-hmm. you know, oh my God, she's wearing those orange cowboy boots, was it?
Yeah,
oh my God,
like
she
that.
Has to take off those pants.
Right.
And
right.
And I just thought that was really funny.
Yeah. That story's... there's that going on, but the other thing that's going on in that story is that the person who's, or the you of the story, who's being critical of the other woman, is also dealing, I think, with her own internalized homophobia. So everything the other woman does is wrong,
in
bad taste, even though she's crazy about her. And you'll see in this longer version of the story here that by the end the woman who's doing all the complaining is in fact totally seduced. By the end, and the other one has it over her completely, despite her not very great clothes.
Despite the sophistication,
I think I love the way dress is changing with lesbians. I think especially younger lesbians, it's really wonderful the way they often dress. I really approve of that.
When you first came to Montreal, were you out yourself, or were you...
No, I was married when I first came to Montreal.
I see. So has this been a process for you as well?
Has what been a process for
you? Well, the writing of these books and being in Montreal and coming out and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a direct relation. I don't see writing as a therapeutic process at all, and nor do I see it as... Somebody asked me this question once... You know, you've published this book and this book and this book, and in this book it was, I don't know, you were a single woman, and in the next book, getting a divorce, and in the next book, a lesbian. Does this correspond to your life?
And?
Well, I don't see, I just don't see life and writing as being that directly, of course they're intricately entwined. But I don't see them as directly reflecting each other. For me, there has to be a chance always to be able to go back in writing. And I don't think... Somebody else asked me recently, do you see yourself as a lesbian writer? Well, of course I'm a lesbian. Of course I'm a writer. But I've also spent a good deal of my life doing other things. And I'm not going to now sit down and write only about lesbians. And furthermore, it interests me much more to write about how people interact with larger social contexts. So again... if a lesbian writer means you only write about lesbians, which it seems to mean for some people, then the question's really problematic. And in fact, my next book, I think, will be written in the voices of men.
Really?
And I'm not planning a sex change. So I don't think that the relationship is direct. I think what does come from a writer into her work more is is the way she experiences the larger questions in life, things like melancholia, for example, which I think is a really important element of heroine, and which becomes externalized in this book onto the social context, so that it's not actually, I think, the narrator herself who is melancholic, but who's a person rather who is both absorbing and resisting the context around her, which certainly gives her plenty of reason for melancholy.
Okay. I keep saying okay to you because what you're saying seems to, there seems to be no, you know, follow up. You said it all. I was actually going to ask you a question, though, that was sort of related to that earlier one, which you brought up yourself, about being a Villain Rose. And I think that was the first time, at least, I had seen you referred to as the lesbian writer when you appeared on the lesbian writers reading panel with Erin Moray at the Villain Rose conference.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so I wondered if that was a new thing and how you felt. Did you affix that title, or were you sort of told, you know, you can appear on this panel and this is the name that we're giving it?
No, people have certainly, I mean, Erin and I have been together for, you know, 10 years, and this is not a secret. for 9 years, actually. No, I mean, I've been writing, even my first book, Spare Parts. I don't know if you've read my first book, Spare Parts, but the first story and the last story in that book also have, especially the last story. In the last story, the narrator is accused in a very threatening way of being a lesbian, and I find that really interesting because I really had no intention then of doing anything about whatever I might be feeling at the time. And I mean I think it's pretty clear for people who are interested in gossip and autobiography what I do with my life. But as I said, it's not necessarily directly reflected in my writing.
Go ahead.
No.
Okay. You're finished. I was going to ask you about Erin Moray because she came on the show earlier this year and she talked about having your input and, you know, working with you and how important that was. Do you feel the same way? Do you feel that there's... it's your chance. I know. But how do you feel about being so closely connected with someone who's also a writer? Does that help your work?
It depends what you mean by closely connected. Publicly, actually, on the whole, I've tried to avoid a really close connection because I think it's really hard for women writing. At any rate, we tend to get ghettoized in the minds of other people. And to be the sort of, perfect lesbian couple, both of whom write, somehow it just doesn't make me feel as free as I want to feel in my own space and in my public space as well. But it's obvious that when you're together with a woman who also cares about writing as much as you do, that there is a lot of support, a lot of discussion. When Erin first came here, she was really keen on learning about Quebec and Quebec writing, and I was really involved in that at the time. So our discussions kind of took off from there. And I think we've both changed a lot, both in our writing and in our relationship to the world around us since then. And on the whole, I'd say it's been a fruitful relationship.
I was talking to Betsy Warland. She was on the show, and I'm talking to her about her relationship with Daphne Marlett. And there you go. There you have your perfect lesbian writer couple who are very closely associated with each other.
They are. Their work is sometimes very symbiotic in as much as they often do collaborations and so on. I'm really not interested in that. And I don't think Erin would be either.
You're not interested in collaborating?
No, I'm not interested in that kind of occupying a private or public space that way. I'm not interested in I just don't see life that way. I'm just not that kind of person, you know. For me, the couple is not the end all and be all. And
because you still live in separate spaces.
We live in separate spaces. We spend a lot of time traveling. I'm going to Paris for 6 months now. And so on, you know. I mean, it's a very, very different kind of thing. We have different friends, you know.
You're not joined at the hip, basically.
We're not joined at the hip, no.
Okay. I'm thinking about the theme of violence against women that is, I can see a lot of in your work, and the larger concerns of a lot of feminist theory, and I know that that's been a big impact on your work Would you like to talk about how? Are you reading a lot of feminist theory right now, or have you? Are you drawing on what you've read in the past?
I don't know what you mean by feminist theory.
I was thinking of Cixous names? And you know, the standards, Kristeva and that sort of stuff, Irigaray, the French feminists for one thing,
yeah.
And also a lot of, well, I was basically thinking of a scene in the Massachusetts Review mm-hmm. piece in which the two women are kissing in a bar mm-hmm. and someone says, oh, women have been killed or beaten yeah. up for less
beaten
than
up.
That.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a very, you know, prosaic mm-hmm. level of everyday mm-hmm. violence. Mm-hmm. And finding a woman's body in the park is mm-hmm. also a kind yeah. of illustration
yeah.
of that.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I actually think that those examples have more to do with everyday experience than they do with theory. Kristeva and Irigaray, I read in the mid-70s. And certainly they nourished my work very much at the beginning, the late 70s when I started to write. But hopefully one evolves a long way from one's earliest reading. I don't know if 10 years ago is still what you nourish yourself on when you write, but it's not my case. Kristeva's a different story because she's a theoretician who I haven't been reading her recently, actually, but certainly she was extremely important to me during the 80s. And I don't think you can really call her a feminist theoretician. I think she's a semiotician, and I think she belongs in a different category probably than the other two, whose theoretical work has been more focused on one issue. Kristeva's written a lot about poetic language, for example. She's written a lot about various aspects of metaphysics, philosophy. She's written, you know, psychoanalysis, it's very different. And then I actually think the word feminist theory gets thrown around in a really reductive way by people who aren't very conversant in it. In Quebec, a really important thing happened, which to my knowledge didn't happen at the same time, that is in the late 70s, early 80s, anywhere else, which is that Quebec women kind of brought together the theories of the new French feminists and post-structuralist theory. That didn't even really happen in France in terms of the production of poetry and prose. It didn't happen in North America until much later. And when it did happen in English North America, the Quebec women were taken for a model. So in fact, it's a very kind of privileged place to come from. But writers like Derrida and Deleuze and any number of other writers have also been, you know, part of what I've read, but also just people writing here and how their own work on language and using language as a material as opposed to as using language as a transparency, where those two things come together.
Can you name some Quebec writers who've influenced you?
Oh, lots. Hubert Aquin, have you? Especially his book Prochain Episode, Hubert Aquin was... which he wrote, well, I believe he wrote it while he was in jail, having been accused of an FLQ collaboration. I'm not quite sure the nature of it. He committed suicide in the late 70s. He's a very important prose writer. And then, of course, I work with a group of women, or have worked with a group of Québécois writers for several years, France Théoré, Nicole Brassard, Lucky Persianic, Louise Cotenoir, and Louise Dupré. And I think certainly we've influenced each other. There are some wonderful male poets in Quebec, too, that we don't know very much about in English, because poetry is such a non-commercial venture right now, and there's not much translation going on, but there's a poet called Roger Desroches, who's really a great poet. There's another one called Normand de Bellefeuille. Their poetry is both very concrete and very deconstructivist, I guess, for want of a better word. Their work is interesting, but I think that I write really at a conjuncture between narrative writing, which is really still what dominates in the English North American novel, and what's right. going on in Quebec.
Do you write any poetry yourself?
No.
No. Why not?
Because I guess my great dream in life is to make the novel as poetic as possible.
Okay.
I really see, in particularly this novel, I kind of see like a field of language. It's seven portraits and seven texts between them, which kind of join the portraits together. The text between are the voice of Lydia sitting in the bar, but they reverberate off one another with hundreds, thousands of little details in a way that's not quite narrative, but which I think gets the feel of narrative across in a different way.
Would you like to read an excerpt from Maine Brides now that we're back to it?
I'll read a section from the piece that you saw in the Massachusetts Review, which was a reduced version of a longer story. This one's called Canadian Girls. Consider light moving through lace curtains into a white room. A woman with very blonde skin is lying on a white bed. She's drunk. The thin strap of her blue camisole falls almost delicately off one shoulder, alabaster-colored like the shoulder of some heroine of history, in white stone against a blue sky. But under the tousled blonde hair and disarray in the forehead, the face's slack muscles hang in a loose grimace of despair, more like the faces of those women rubbies you used to see in the beer cafes in Stockholm. You lean over and sniff the pale nipple, feeling angry because you've given up a radio show to be with her this night before she goes to Calgary. Why, only a week ago on April 4th, your singing body sat on the cement front steps enjoying sun and early daffodils and trying to assimilate the confusing pleasure of the night before. How put off you were when your gangly boy's body stood up and hugged you greedily in the woman's bar. You hated the nervous bending of the knees, the huge feet and sawed-off cowboy boots, the faded cowboy shirt. Quickly you retreated from her grasp. Then, as if a hand had turned, in another bar you suddenly noticed her white skin blushing slightly over high cheekbones, the elegantly curved nose, the kind you like, and her soft pink mouth. Provocatively, you moved your shoulder close to hers and said, "How do you and your lover..." She had a girlfriend in Alberta, handle sleeping with other people. She said, 99.5% of the time I only sleep with her. You looked into your café au lait and realized how much you wanted her, covering your desire by nodding at the mustache-smiling, confidently virile Portuguese guys leaning on the bar while whispering from the corner of your mouth, "How are we going to make them understand we don't like pricks?" And she, to your eternal joy, answered, "Maybe like this." Grasping your head in her hands and covering your face with kisses from her mouth, sa bouche écœurante, pink, delicious. Tu me fais trembler comme une feuille dans le vent avant la pluie. Sitting on the cement steps writing backwards in the little Chinese book she gave you, you notice the daffodils holding their little cups up to the darkening April sky so impatiently they also trembled and didn't care if love produces clichés.
Thank you very much. That was Gail Scott reading from her latest book, Maine Brides. And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
For those people who want to catch her at the launching of your book.
It's Bistro Cat, Monday, June 7th at 6 o'clock.
Thank you.